on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
A big Gurumila Mahagwiv to the two Johnnies for another entertaining afternoon. You're listening to Game On. I'm Shane Dawson. It is Wednesday the 23rd of February and we have a packed hour, as always, of sport to get through. Coming up a bit later on, we'll have Greg Allen live in studio to chat all things golf and the small matter of Phil Mickelson and the disharmony, to put it lightly, that he's causing. We'll have Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray live as well, giving their lowdown on all things LGF and Camogie from last weekend, and indeed we'll be looking forward to Congress this weekend, and of course the big, hopefully the big amalgamation of the LGFA and the Camogie Associations coming under the one umbrella of the GAA. And if that wasn't enough, we have Association Football with David Snaid. That is of course Premier League this evening and Champions League from last night and tonight.
Game on 2FM.
Yes, hello there. You are very welcome wherever you are tuning in from on this Wednesday evening. To Game On, a couple of news headlines to get through. First, what's caught my eye today? Kelly Harrington and Aoife O'Rourke have both guaranteed themselves medals at the 73rd International Strandja Tournament in Sofia, Bulgaria, having won on Tuesday in her first fight back since claiming gold in the Tokyo 2020 final. Kelly followed that up today, beating Kazakhstan's Aydana Zebenbakova to reach the lightweight semi-finals. Elsewhere, Michaela Walsh was beaten by her Russian opponent in her featherweight quarter-final, also in action from Team Ireland on day four, where Caitlin Fryers and Luke Maguire. In rugby, Ireland captain Johnny Sexton says he is good to go ahead of Sunday's Guinness Six Nations meeting with Italy. Meanwhile, Ian Henderson will miss out due to COVID, and Tom O'Toole will miss out on any potential game time due to a hamstring issue. And more petulance in tennis. World number three, Alexander Zverev, has been thrown out of the Mexican Open after unsportsmanlike conduct that saw him attack the umpire's chair at the end of a doubles match in Acapulco. I suppose I shouldn't laugh as I'm saying that. Final bit of news is League of Ireland, and I'd welcome David Snaid into the conversation. Derry City have announced that boat manager Rory Higgins and key player Ronan Boyce have signed four-year contracts at the club. It sees the pair remain at the club until at least the end of 2025. Derry chairman Philip O'Doherty has reiterated his commitment to the long-term plan in place at the Brandywell as he continues to put in significant investment into the club. David, that's enough of me talking. League of Ireland and four-year deals. It's not something that you usually see in the same sentence.
The boom is back. I would say there are players. This news will probably go around to a few players, and then WhatsApp will be pinging with lads now, and someone will be like, "What is this? This is unheard of."
Yeah.
Also, there'll be players in England. Agents will be getting a hold of this and seeing this, and any club that is handing out four-year contracts to its players, agents will be looking at them and saying, this could be a place to be pumping their player to, because it is a sign, like you mentioned there, Philip O'Doherty. For those who don't know, obviously he, self-made man, sold his firm recently and made quite a few bob. I think it was in billions now. How much of that is his personal fortune now remains to be seen, but he'd already been funding Derry to a significant amount, keeping the show on the road there, and it just adds to a kind of sense of the stability that is there now up at the Roy McBride Brandywell.
Is there stability though? Sorry to cut across you there, because we see when there's money involved in League of Ireland, I'm always very cautious.
I know, and you're right to be. I would say, because of the people who are involved, and you look at the fact that he's given a manager that length of contract, Rory Higgins took over the job midway through last season, so in the 3.5 year deal then, so he's getting an extension at this point in terms of the work that he's been doing, the work that's happening behind the scenes there as well. And you do get the sense that if you're going to see a League of Ireland that's going to thrive, and you're going to see a League of Ireland whereby it's not going to be maybe a one club show, like you see Rovers going for the 3 in a row titles before we've seen it, where thankfully we had a bit of a battle in the most part of the last decade between Dundalk and Cork City. If you're looking at this is a show of intent by Derry that they're going to be the ones to stand up to Rovers for the years to come and put the foundations in place to be able to actually say, do you know what, we're here and we mean business. The fact that Ronan Boyce, another player who you can be sure, he's on a 4-year contract, that means then that if he is to be prized away by any other League of Ireland club or a club in England, if it's to happen, they're going to have offer him something serious. So listen, I think it does bode well. And you mentioned there, and you're right, like, you can kind of, it does. This is the way, I think it's a very good point. Like, listen, does it inflate the market a little bit with people looking at this saying, well, Derry are offering this, I want that. They're like, I know people in the PFAI have kind of looked at it as well and said, you know, our wage is creeping up a little bit again, and we're talking about wanting to get certain contracts and standardised contracts for players, because there's still some clubs who will be offering, say, a 1-year deal to a player, but it's not 1 year, so it's not even for 52 weeks of the year, it's for the season. It's only been recently where PFAI are fighting for clubs to pay their players during pre-season. So listen, like, if this is one club being able to actually step away a little bit financially in the short term, then that's an issue. What you would hope is, and the fact that they're giving a contract here to a manager and to a promising young player, rather than throwing money at lads who are maybe 29, 30 years old and trying to get short term, that's the hope here, is that it's them again building blocks slow and steady, and slow and steady wins the race. And you can imagine that it won't be long before Derry City are winning stuff again.
Absolutely, always a nice trip up to the Brandywell, very atmospheric. So yeah, positive news and football and money. That leads me on perfectly to the Champions League. Champions League last night, David, Chelsea, Lille, Chelsea 2-0 in truth, could have been 4 or 5, to be honest. I suppose the headline news, no Lukaku. Thomas Tuchel has come out and said it was the moment to take a step back in relation to Kai Havertz, who seemingly is the big player for the big occasion for Chelsea, stepping up and starting ahead of Lukaku. And then Villarreal and Juventus, the headline from that, I suppose, Dusan Vlahovic scoring the quickest Champions League debut goal ever, but Juventus were pegged back to draw at Villarreal thanks to a goal from Danny Parejo. I saw someone comment on Twitter, and I'm not sure if you agree or not, that this seemed just like a drab group stage match, not a knockout round of football. But what did you make of the two matches last night?
Part of me was laughing where, like, we're coming off a week where Lukaku had 7 touches in a game against Crystal Palace and getting absolutely slaughtered for it. But then Dusan Vlahovic shows you in his first and second touch, he scores his first goal in the Champions League. Like, I don't know, I think, yeah, like, it's almost like a soap opera around Chelsea, isn't it? It's like, partly, remember, obviously, what's going on with United and all this, and it's like nonsense. It's like Coronation Street in EastEnders half the time, you know what I mean? But I think what's very interesting, and how Tuchel is kind of managing this whole situation with Lukaku. We were in here a couple of months ago, and you're talking Chelsea are going to be in this title race, and it looked as if it was going to be a 3-way title race in the Premier League. It was like geared up to be probably one of the most thrilling seasons we've seen in the Premier League, and then Lukaku drops an absolute bombshell like Bianca used to do in EastEnders. So now Ricky has half of it. That was probably the kind of the shout going around the dressing room about Lukaku, because he out of nowhere just has his interview. It wasn't even as if the whole season was a write off. He'd been actually playing pretty decent. There was a, you know, you go through those spells where maybe things aren't going great for you, and then, like, all of a sudden he just throws this bombshell into the dressing room, and it's something else that he has to contend with. And I think Tuchel could be in a very strong position at the end of the season if, like, he's already won the Champions League with the club, but, like, if he can finish the season strongly and go to the board and go to Abramovich, Abramovich and all the rest of what's going on there, but I don't want to mention it. But, like,
we'll keep it light, David.
Yeah,
we'll keep it light.
I know, but, like, he could be in a serious strong position, and Lukaku could be at another point in his career where, like, there's only so many times you can say, oh, a move didn't work out. You have to realise, well, why didn't it? Like, he looked as if he had properly gotten his career back on track and rebuilt his reputation at Inter Milan after a bit of a shambles at Manchester United. It does have to be said, where, like, he was overweight, he wasn't match fit, he wasn't sharp, he looked so far off the pace, and then Conte just totally revitalised him at Inter Milan. And you were kind of thinking, you know what, fair play to him, he's actually properly knuckled down, he's got his career on track here. He looked to be not just this, like, flat track bully who would be able to, like, do it against the weaker teams. He was bossing teams, he was, like, his all round play, he was looking like the complete centre forward, hence the reason why Chelsea wanted to bring him back to Stamford Bridge and spend nearly £100 million on him, because he was like shaping up to be, this could be the fella who could be the best striker in the world for the next couple of years. And then this season has just been a shambles for him. And I don't think it's his fault necessarily that Chelsea have petered away. It's just, you kind of wonder, like, Tuchel clearly would have wanted to get him in the building because of what he was doing at Inter Milan, but it just hasn't worked. And, like, not to labour the point on EastEnders and soap operas, but, like, will there be a final twist for the rest of the season where he comes good and actually delivers something? Because it could be the only way he might be able to save his career at Stamford Bridge.
I was tempted to just reel off the EastEnders theme tune there, but I'll hold back. Well, speaking of, you mentioned there shambles this season. So let's chat Atletico Madrid, Manchester United. I do say that in jest because United won the War of Roses. Rumours of their demise were greatly exaggerated. Bruno Fernandes has come out and said a divide in the camp is nonsense. Ralph Rangnick on the pitch giving it large to the away support afterwards. Paul Pogba sliding after Harry Maguire. Bruno reporting to say, I was slapping Harry's head saying you finally scored with this big thing. Goal from the corner. I mean, to paraphrase yourself, David, the boom's back. The boom's back at Manchester United. All of this slanderous talk that possibly myself in weeks previous, yourself in weeks previous, and yeah, a certain unnamed pundit, let's just call him A. Colley, has we've all stuck the boot in on Man United. But now the boom's back, it's all rosy.
Well, it's actually, if you look at the stats, right, look at what's happened at United since Ralph Rangnick has come in, and it's only Man City you've collected more points than them in the Premier League. And yeah, you don't get that sense because week after week there's been nothing but leaks coming out of the dressing room and stories of discontent. And you only have to even see in the last couple of days, I think it was yesterday, Miguel Delaney had a, it's well worth reading, it's in the London Independent online, just incredible article about the level of just the nature of the shambles behind the scenes at every level that's still there with Manchester United. The fact that Ralph Rangnick, who was brought in as and is going to have this 2-year consultancy after he finishes as the interim manager, still hasn't properly had a sit-down meeting with Richard Arnold to actually discuss, well, what happens next. Part of the reason is because he's firefighting every single day. And like there's stories, like there's lines in that again about Bruno Fernandes and about, like, you think, look at the influence that he's had on United since he came, when he signed in January of 2020, I think it was, and just totally he revitalised that club. The club was stagnant, it was going nowhere, and that bit of flair and ingenuity and just off the cuff thinking, which had been totally devoid at Old Trafford, he provided it. But then bit by bit, as the other teams have obviously got so much more improved and got their act together, and United have just bit by bit gone the other way. And then those little bits of just a bit of madness from Bruno Fernandes and the bits of off the cuff and playing the pass that maybe no one else is, those things that were working brilliantly have maybe stopped working a little bit. And then you throw in the Ronaldo factor. And then there's one line in this article from Miguel, and it kind of plays to the wider issue of the lack of, say, even understanding football-wise with coaching. When there was a player brought in for a 45-minute video session by the head coach, is going through stuff because he feels, well, the message isn't going properly through on the training pitch, so I'll speak to him one-on-one. And all that he goes through doesn't actually get delivered on the pitch, and then that player subsequently doesn't play at all in the next game. So it's just, like, there are still major issues there. Like, they beat Leeds United. Like, look at where Leeds are in the table. Like, it is a derby game, and it was a bit of a throwback because of the weather and the conditions and the atmosphere. It was mental. But looking at this game that's going to be happening later on, like, 2-0 up, they look to be in total control, but United just still have that in them where they, even in the space of 30 seconds, control away a 2-goal lead. Now, looking at the game later on with Atletico Madrid, if we were to look at a team that's in a bit of disarray defensively, have question marks over a manager, have problems scoring goals, have an aging forward who's causing maybe issues, you would think that's Man United. But that's everything that's being said about Atletico Madrid this year. Like, what if everyone talks about Atletico Madrid, you think the absolute warrior at the back, Diego Godin, you know, taking on all comers, is one of the reasons they're able to get to 2 Champions League finals, win two La Liga's under Simeone, who was the longest serving manager in Serie A since like 2011. But now they've got like the worst defensive record in the top half of Serie A.
Yep.
Like, it's set up to either be a beautifully shambolic game where it could actually be about 2-1. So, and then on the flip side, then you've got Ajax and Benfica, and then there could be people looking at it thinking, well, what's Erik ten Hag going to be doing, and is he going to be the next man through the door at Old Trafford? So it's going to be an interesting evening.
Absolutely. We do have to move the conversation on to GAA, but David, you're going to stick around because we're going to have a few voices from our Premier League grounds a little bit later on, and I'll be getting your opinion as well, and we'll touch on Benfica Ajax because that is one for the purists.
Bit of Coronation Street talk.
I won't tell the listeners that I've had to actually Google Ricky EastEnders in front of me here. I'm more of a Fair City man.
Okay.
Yeah, staunch, local, parochial stuff for me. Anyway, we will be moving on. David, thank you very much. We'll be chatting to you in a little while later. In fact, David, before you do leave, I do want to pose one question to you. And 51552 is the text line. If anyone does know the answer, when we are, and you've got a bit of while now to think on this. So Leeds Liverpool is this evening. We'll be previewing the Premier League later. Virgil van Dijk has never lost a Premier League home match for Liverpool, winning 50 and drawing 8 of his 58 appearances at Anfield. If he plays and Liverpool avoid defeat, it will equal a former Manchester United player who holds the record for most Premier League home matches at a specific club without ever losing. That record is 59, winning 47, drawing 12. Don't answer now. Go home, go think about it. 51552 is the answer if you do know it. And we'll be back in a few moments' time as we turn our attention to GAA, and we'll be live with Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on
GAA.
Hello again, you're very welcome back to Game On. It is great to have your company wherever you are tuning in from, and I'm delighted to be in the company of Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray as we turn our attention to, I suppose we turn our attention to the GAA. Am I allowed to say that yet? Because it hasn't been, we're not all under the one umbrella just yet. So before we look back on the weekend's results, both in the LGFA and indeed the Camogie, obviously the big talking point is Congress this weekend. All eyes on motion 33, which I suppose to break it down is Motion 33. This motion comes from the GPA. It calls on the GAA to prioritise integration with the LGFA and the Camogie Association. This motion, if passed, would not result in a change in the rules. One of the functions of Congress is to direct the association with regard to fundamental policy matters, and that's what this, in effect, will do if the motion is passed. Nadine, we're fully expecting this motion to pass, and if it does so, what does that mean in terms of, okay, it's all well and good to say it's passed and to say we're all equal and we're all under one umbrella. Do you think will be immediate change if that is the case?
No, Shane, I don't at all. And while I do think this will pass, I still think there's a long way to go. I don't think it's going to happen in the next couple of years. I really don't. You know, we look back at 2015, and we've spoken about this before, and Liam O'Neill tried to open formal discussions, and there is a perception out there that it was solely the LGFA who refused the advances. But, you know, and this is pure speculation, I think it was more than that. You know, at the time, O'Neill openly said that it would mean the end of the GAA county boards and structures. They'd essentially be scrapped, and there'd be huge changes across the GAA, and that would still remain today if it was passed. And again, I'm just merely speculating, but I doubt very much Liam had the support of the whole GAA community. But look, a lot has changed now. There's a lot of differences. Society has changed its attitude to women in sport, equality. You know, there's general consensus. They're in favour of one association. The player voice is stronger, and not just the GPA. I think the players themselves, their expectations are higher in terms of having the basics, and they are basics like pitches and resources and so on. I think one thing that stands out with all this is the demand for playing pitches, and I think it's far greater now because the playing numbers are massive across all three associations. And, you know, the majority of controversies have been over pitches. And if Camogie and the LGFA had their own pitches, I don't think the pressure would be on for this amalgamation. And again, just I think the main difference between now and back then is we now have three associations who are in very different positions to what they were 7 years ago. And they have more bargaining tools, I feel, if they decide to come to the table. And so I was looking at the LGFA. They're now in a much stronger position to negotiate because they've built an empire out of nothing. And I feel their main aim is, I do think they want it. I do think they do, but not yet. But they want to retain autonomy. And while the LGFA do feel they have their playing membership, their best interests at heart, I think there is a bit of a disparity and I suppose a lack of connection there and understanding of what the player membership wants and perhaps the administration. So I feel that's probably what's going to hold this up a little bit.
Aoife Murray, if I bring you into the conversation, and Nadine touched on it there in terms of Liam O'Neill has previously said that the biggest regret of his time in office was that he didn't get this over the line, I suppose, and it wasn't possible. And he did go on to say for some reason there was a bit of mistrust there. Do you feel that has changed now, Aoife, in your opinion? Because, yes, a lot of people are saying that, what is it, 97% of intercounty players support this, so it should be passed. But it's at the moment, surely, the blame for facilities and venues is at, you know, the fault of the LGFA and at the fault of the Camogie at the moment, their own respective county boards, because it isn't good enough to see players, the likes of Sarah Dervin, speaking about their players being thrown out and having facility issues. Aisling Maher of Dublin beforehand, not even knowing where games were played. I mean, we will be chatting on the Camogie results from the last weekend and Dublin losing to All-Ireland champions Galway, which was played in Grange Gorman, according to the Camogie website, when it was out in Round Towers, Clondalkin, and Aisling kind of commented that in terms of even preparing from a match, from a mental side of things, the sports psychology, visualization of perspective of the game, that can be a real challenge. So do you think that the challenges now that the Camogie Association has faced is quite large for themselves, and that they will be eradicated and that there is a bit more trust now across the board?
I think, going back to the start, with regard to has things changed since when Liam O'Neill said that, I'm going back to 2015. I think what has changed is, and I think Nadine has pointed out, is the players. And I think there's greater trust now between both the female and the male players. I think, in fairness to our male county players, they've educated themselves, and possibly through the process of the GPA and WGPA coming together, I think they've educated themselves exceptionally well over the past 12 or 15 months and have maybe acknowledged the massive delta between the two experiences. So I think that's firstly, I think that's what's changed massively since, we just take 2015 as that date. Has it changed with regard to the three NGBs? I'm not so sure, unfortunately. I think if anything, I do feel maybe the LGFA and the Camogie Association are slightly nervous of that player's voice. And I think Nadine hit the point there of a disconnection. And I think when this gets passed, and if it doesn't get passed, we're in greater trouble as a society if it doesn't. But when this does pass, the pressure will be immense on the three NGBs. And then I think we'll really understand where they sit, Shane, and especially where is that trust level between the players who are actually playing this game and the people who are in the office running it. So that, for me, is the big thing to look at with regard to what has changed. And towards, I suppose, the latter end of your question with regard to facilities and who's to blame, you know, I suppose blame is a very strong word. Unfortunately, even though Camogie has been in existence since 1903, I think, was when it was founded, and we have little to no county grounds. I know Cork were very lucky to have Castle Road, but like that, we have three adult teams and a team at every single underage group, if not two to three teams. We only have one pitch, and that scene is such a positive. So questions have to be asked there. Why haven't we got more county grounds? And we are still begging and borrowing grounds from the GAA. So look, I suppose that is a disappointment that we haven't been able to push that side of it on.
And Aoife, just to come in there, you know, when you're saying about the lads getting on board, and I agree with you 100%, but I think in terms of the GPA, yeah, you know, the lads, they're very vocal, and there are a lot of male players around the country who are the same, but I feel they've a little bit to go. You know, I don't know if they realise the huge level of accountability and responsibility they maybe have to enact change, because whether they are aware of it or want to acknowledge it, they have a massive level of influence. And like, I'm not just talking about the lads in the LGPA. Like, Conor Myler called it during the week when he said that they've all been turning a blind eye and think it's okay to do so. And I'd say Conor's eyes were open there in the last few months because he's involved with St Mary's. But, you know, just an example would be a friend of mine. She's currently being coached by a lad off the senior team in her club. And she said up until this year, like, they'd struggle for pitches, they'd struggle for everything. And since that guy came in, she was like, they could have a pitch any time of the day or night. So, you know, what I would say to lads in clubs, counties, you know, don't just tweet about how terrible things are while you'd welcome that. You know, make it tangible. You know, make the phone calls, call out the people in your club who are discriminating. And I think with the lads and the females in every club, county all together, they would be able to build on that groundwork and enact that massive change that is needed in order for all three to come together. Because if 3% in the GPA voted no, I know it's only small, but 3% across the whole playing community across the country equates to about 25,000 people. So, you know, there is a good bit to go there. But I do think if the lads step up tangibly and keep doing what they're doing with a little bit more, to make a huge difference.
I just think as well though, right,
I know you're saying the 3% and that's 25,000 people or thereabouts, right? It would be interesting to see where that survey was back in 2015, okay? And I think it's great to see the journey that we've gone on over the past 7 years and how much guys have educated themselves. And I completely agree. Rather than automatically going to your phone to tweet about it, why don't you get involved, okay, and understand it? I always get very disappointed when you hear a guy come out and say, I didn't realise how bad it was until I had a daughter. Yeah. And I'm going, listen, I'm sure you've been in female company through sport for many years. So why didn't you open your eyes? Why did it take you to have a daughter? You know, what were your experiences up to that? You obviously were quite blinkered, I'd imagine, but you didn't look around at maybe your sister or your mother and seen the experiences that they were having, which were quite different to yours. So rather than guys wait to have a daughter to actually figure out just how I suppose wide the gap is on the experiences of not just on the pitch but off the pitch, Nadine, as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
So I would see the 97% and go, wow, isn't that amazing to see how far we've come? And at least guys are educating themselves on it. And at least they're open for the conversation, and we have to start somewhere. And I think being open to learn is not the best place to start.
Yeah, and just really quickly, I think in order for this to really happen, I think there has to be political will, but that's for another day's conversation, Shane, I'd say.
Unfortunately, we've only got the hour. But no, I completely agree, and sorry, I wasn't meaning to speak over Aoife there. It was more so kind of to reinforce the point as well. Nicole Owens and Niamh McAvoy on Twitter even today, Nicole Owens mentioned, we're all playing the same sport, but without equal access to resources, we can never be on an equal playing field. Ladies football has moved so far beyond the we'll take what we're given mentality, and it's about time that was reflected in the structure of the governing bodies. And of course, I'm saying these words, but if you have a look at the tweet, ladies is in inverted commas as well, because it is the same sport. And I think that's what's important to note as well. She went on to mention, my club played in the All-Ireland Interclub Final this year on the worst condition pitch I've ever played on, in a venue that didn't even have enough capacity, resulting in half the crowd having to stand in the lashing rain for the entire match. The men's final was in Croke Park. And then Niamh McAvoy mentioned as well, it's so disappointing when footballers want to produce a good spectacle and play a nice brand, particularly women who feel that we are representing our game as a whole when we step out to play and you get landed on an unplayable pitch, never mind the fact it was dangerous. Important to note though, Niamh did mention it was not the fault of the chosen club, whom did their best to accommodate the match. The venue was just not fit for purpose, and the LGFA should have never fixed the match there. The crowd in amongst the subs and so close to the keeper that they could sledge her was bizarre. So I think it's really important that, yes, Conor Myler's quote that, Nadine, you mentioned a bit earlier in terms of, as a male intercounty footballer, by standing by and being quiet, you are part of the problem. And it's great to see that 97% are speaking up, but they're not being quiet anymore. But as Nicole said, we're all playing the same sport. So whatever you can say, it's about equality. But Nadine, it's about basic respect as well.
Yeah, basic respect. And we said basic rights. Nobody's asking for anything less or more. We're just looking for that parity that we can try and achieve equality. And I think compared to when I was playing, I played an All-Ireland Club Final in 2014. And again, no harm to the club in Longford who hosted us. Fair play to them. But like, no more than this year, you wouldn't have put cattle on the field. And that's nearly 10 years ago. So things have to change. And as Nicole said, and she put it brilliantly, like, we can't be happy with the scraps. So it just has to change. And I really hope I'm wrong. I really hope it happens quickly. But as we said before, and we said it last week or 2 weeks ago, myself and Aoife, the roadmap is what's needed. Accountability, aims, strategies, and people have to be held accountable. And if you don't want it to happen, come out and say why. Like, what do you want for it to happen? Say it publicly, because we're all kind of tired of you don't know the full story. Tell us the full story and tell us why. That's
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think Conor mentioned, you know, standing by and being quite a part of the problem. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like there is anyone speaking out against this motion. So, but it will be interesting, you see, in terms of implementing a roadmap, because I mentioned at the start there, in terms of Congress, one of the functions is to direct the association with regard to fundamental policy matters. And that's what this motion will hopefully do. So, yes, it is a story that will be continued and a story that we'll be discussing at length, hopefully for not too long, because hopefully it is more positive than negative. Briefly, before we move on, there was a couple of matches at play as well. So there is, I suppose, on-field action as well. Nadine, if we stick with LGFA football, Dublin demolishing the Rebels, Hannah Tyrrell 1-9. Was that a shock result, I suppose?
Yeah, I was very surprised. I was at the game, actually, and I was there with my nephew, and we thought it was going to be a tight game, but Dublin were incredible. They've laid down a marker. Hannah got 1-9, 1-8 from frees and a penalty. I thought Nicole Owens was fantastic. Orla Nolan, Niamh Heatherton, they just dominated from start to finish. Couldn't fault them in any area. And I spoke last week, I was kind of worried that Dublin had lost their bite a little bit. But by God, did they have it on Saturday. Cork were so poor, though. I mean, I was so surprised at how bad they were.
Would you be worried?
It's really early and the league or the championship's 5 months away, but I would be worried for their kickouts. It's like their old Achilles heel was back. The kickouts imploded with 15 minutes gone and that was it, game over. I've been disappointed with their league because they now have to beat Waterford to avoid a relegation playoff. And I suppose I just felt with Renan coming in, he's been 5 years at Mourne Abbey. He knows Cork football. He's been involved in women's football for 10 years with TIP and UCC. I just thought he would have had more of an idea of the team he's going to play and his structures. But it just looked like a complete disaster on Saturday. But look, I wouldn't be worried for them yet, but they have massive, massive improvements to make over the coming months.
Yeah, it's always difficult to judge after just two matches played. But two defeats nonetheless, and Dublin obviously wounded after last year, and a wounded Mick Bone and a wounded Dublin.
They're a dangerous animal in Crow Park on
Saturday
night.
Speaking of dangerous teams, Meath, a fairly convincing win over Waterford there through to the semi-final as well. 12 starters from that All-Ireland final. Emma Duggan, I should say, 6 points, you know, an all-star when you have these players. Vicky Ward, they're household names now. And
they
household names.
It's brilliant. And they, as you said, they started with 12 out of 15. They started with 13 out of 15 the week before. But in both games, they've brought on 7 subs. So look, they're looking to progress in the long term. Vicky and Emma had quiet games actually against Cork. So that just shows their superstar status. They come back a week later, 1-6 between them. And what I was impressed with them, their last quarter against the week before against Cork, they failed to score for the last 15 minutes and they tagged on 4 or 5 points and finished really strongly against Waterford. And look, Waterford again, they battled again as they did against Dublin, but they just don't have that quality to really, really challenge teams in Division 1. But yeah, Meath march on and they'll play Dublin now in 2 weeks, and while they'll meet each other possibly in the league finals, they won't be showing their hands. I still can't wait for it, just to see what they come up with.
Absolutely, we'll have you back in to preview that one in due course, of course. But yeah, cannot wait for that. Briefly, Donegal, 2 wins and a bounce now. Decent win over Westmeath. Karen Guthrie, 2-6, I suppose, the standout there.
Karen did well. Geraldine McLaughlin was absent, so Karen, I suppose, took on the scoring role. That was a bit of a dull game. Now, Westmeath gave them a bit of a scare. I would have thought Donegal would have powered on a little bit more, but the weather was absolutely atrocious. There were videos on Twitter of the goalposts literally moving. So look, Donegal, although far from convincing, we wouldn't have learned much. They got 7 subs on. They're in a league semi-final. They'll be happy enough. And Westmeath will be happy with their performance as well, but they're probably looking at a relegation playoff.
Okay, and very, very briefly, one match this weekend, Galway Mayo, the refixed.
Yeah, so it was postponed because of the weather. Really difficult game to call, Shane, to be honest. Hard to know where both are at, because the first game, they both introduced a lot of players. Obvious what Mayo are working on. You know, you can see a game pattern there with Moyles. They might have Deanne Caldwell, Catherine Sullivan and Tara Needham, the Castlebar girls, back, so they'll give them another boost. And Galway will probably have the Kilcairn club girls back. So I don't know what way that's going to go. Galway Mayo, who knows? But whoever wins, they are ensured a semi-final spot, because you'd presume that Westmeath will lose to Galway in the last game. So it'll be interesting, but hard to call.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you very much, Nadine. Aoife, just briefly on Camogie then, I suppose, very well, we're talking about conditions and very tough conditions. I actually caught some of the Clare Cork match, which was played in just gale force winds. So I'm not sure if you could look into much of it on the pitch. Cork winning 2-6 to 4 points. But I do want to bring up one of the big talking points that came from that was when Clare joint manager Conor Dolan, who was on crutches, and Cork coach Davy Fitzgerald clashed on the sideline. What did you make of this? Because a lot of people were questioning why a Cork coach was even there in the first place. Would you read too much into that narrative?
Not really. I think anybody who asks that question doesn't watch a lot of camogie matches, to be honest, because any camogie match I've been at, there's been coaches on the sideline.
Yeah. That's across all levels as well. So this narrative, I'm not sure where it's coming from.
As I said earlier, it's easy to just go straight to Twitter, isn't it, and pass a comment. Look, obviously, don't want to see it in the game, because the game is about the players playing, not about the people on the sideline, not the coaches and management team, I should say, on the sideline. So it takes away from the game. And in fairness, it was great for Matthew Toomey, manager of Cork, getting his first win. He's been on the management team for a number of years, so I was delighted for that. It's just a pity, completely not a pity, that it was about two men on the sideline rather than the women playing the game.
Yeah, and again, the conditions adding to that. I think Cork got their second goal in added time as well. So perhaps 2-6 to 4 is a bit harsh on Clare. It was a literal game of two halves, as much as I want to avoid cliches because of the weather. Galway, comfortable winners over Dublin, I suppose, Ireland champions as expected, and Tipperary, big winners over Offaly as well, I suppose. Two matches that went by the form book.
Yeah, and look, in fairness, Offaly are missing some players due to the club championship. Tipperary now have racked up as a 7.37 in the first two games, top in their group, so they're flying it, absolutely flying it. And then look, Dublin and Galway, I think Galway are just probably delighted to get back from the last year's All-Ireland win to start the year off winning again. Aoife Donoghue getting the goal. I think for me, look, the weather was so bad at the weekend, it's hard to take anything out of those games. It's a pity that they had to have been played. But I think, look, the pressure really is on a number of games this weekend. You know, Dublin Offaly, that's certainly a game to watch to understand who's going to come out of that one.
Absolutely. Dublin Offaly and Down Galway. You mentioned Tipperary scoring 7.37. They've only conceded 1-8 in, 130 plus minutes of action. So it's unbelievable. And of course, Offaly might have the Rhinos players back. Aoife Murray, thank you very much. We'll have yourself and Nadine back on indeed after Congress. And it will be interesting to see what transpires with that. But for Aoife, thank you. Coming up after the break, we'll have golf. And a little bit later on, we'll be turning our attention back to Association Football. Don't go away.
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Golf.
Hello again. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of February. I'm Shane Dawson. This is Game On, and it's great to have your company. David Snaid is back in studio, and I'm delighted to say RT Sports' Greg Allen is also on the line as we turn our attention to golf. Gentlemen, obviously only one place to start, and that is indeed Phil Mickelson and the disharmony that he has caused. So basically where we're at is, there's been quotes by Phil Mickelson who haven't gone down too well. Roy McIlroy has come out and branded him naive, selfish, egotistical, ignorant. And now, Greg, there has been an apology by Phil Mickelson, who has apologised for his reckless comments about a proposed Saudi-backed breakaway league and said he will be taking a break from golf. The six-time major champion has been one of the players most closely associated with the possible rival to the PGA Tour, which has been spearheaded by former world number one Greg Norman. I suppose my first question to you, Greg, because it's bizarre, it's unprecedented, it's everything else and all that besides. Do you buy Mickelson's apology, Greg?
Mickelson apologising, it's something that he's well used to doing. He's about, I think, five serious gaffes in his career, whether it's saying things about Irish women back in 1991 when he was playing in Portmarnock. He was fairly indiscreet when he was a 20, 21-year-old, saying to a television commentator that after he hit his ball into the crowd and then was forced to play it, he said, well, I don't normally like to play it from here because Irish women aren't all that attractive. That was in 1991, and that was something which he couldn't apologise for enough. And then you fast forward to other things that he's apologised for, like 2004, the Ryder Cup captaincy of Hal Sutton. He waited for about 12 years before he criticised him. But when he criticised Hal Sutton, he did it with both barrels, saying that he shouldn't have been paired with Tiger Woods with only 2 days' notice. And so he heavily criticised Hal Sutton's captaincy in 2004. He also extremely famously heavily criticised Tom Watson's captaincy right in front of Tom Watson and in front of his 11 Ryder Cup teammates in 2004 at Gleneagles. And then there was that bizarre incident at the 2018 US Open when he was on the 13th green and he decided that because the ball had gone past the hole and was rolling down a slope that he didn't want it to roll off the green, so he went and hit a moving ball, which is against all the not just the rules of golf, but the etiquette of golf, just about against every possible rule you can think of in golf, it breaks. It's just not done. So Phil Mickelson has found himself apologising before, and now he's obviously in the situation where he's apologising for something which is, oh, I don't know, where do you categorise it? In an interview with Alan Shipnuck, and Shipnuck is a really, you know, very well-respected American golf and sports journalist and author, Mickelson admitted that his concerns over the Saudi regime and human rights record were secondary to what he was hoping to get from, I suppose, cozying up to the Super League, which was proposed by the Saudis. And that was that he was using the Saudi offer of gazillions of money to leverage more out of the PGA Tour, who he has described as obnoxiously greedy just a few weeks ago. So Mickelson seems to be off the leash even by his own standards. And his apology yesterday was a qualified apology insofar as he said that this was off the record. But Alan Shipnuck disputes that because Shipnuck is writing a biography of Mickelson. He's not writing an autobiography. It's not authorised by Phil Mickelson. But because he's writing a biography of Mickelson, Mickelson wanted to square a few things off with him just to be correct. So Mickelson actually rang Shipnuck. So from the moment that phone call was initiated, everything is on the record. That would be pretty much every journalist reading of a situation like that. And Mickelson now says that it wasn't on the record when he said what he said, basically saying that the Saudis were scary. That's, you know, and he used a lot stronger language than that. And the whole thing has just come out with Phil Mickelson looking fairly foolish, to be brutally honest. He has apologised for his reckless comments. But by saying that the comments weren't on the record, it doesn't matter. He actually said those things, and he said them to a journalist in a conversation that Mickelson actually initiated. So that's really the bones of it all. And I think it's for people to judge, not necessarily for me to comment.
Yeah, and it's funny, you reel off everything there and his other misdemeanors, I suppose, for want of a better word, in the past. And then he comes out and says, I suppose in black and white, although it doesn't look this way now, given my recent comments, my actions throughout this process have always been with the best interests of golf, my peers, my sponsors and fans. And it's just untrue. It's just untrue. And I know sponsors KPMG and Amstel Light have ended their relations with Mickelson, and he was ranked, I think, 21st in the Sportico's 2021 World's Highest Paid Athletes at $46.1 million. And that tally included $42 million from sponsors, appearance fees and bonuses following his surprise PGA Championship in May. Only Tiger Woods with $62.2 million earned more among golfers. So do you feel, Greg, that the reason he's gone to ground now when he's taking a break is just to, I suppose, damage limitations at this? And also, I suppose, the second part of that question would be, where does he go now? Can he come back and redeem himself from this?
Well, firstly, if you're going to make a really bad error of this nature in terms of judging the room, America is not the worst place to do it, because they do like a good bit of contrition. The American sort of sports psychology of the fans is one which does like a fallen idol to perhaps apologise, then serve a bit of time with sackcloth and ashes by the sounds of things, which is what Mickelson probably is going to do while he licks his wounds. And then he'll come back maybe for the Masters. He'll have to face the music at some stage. If he wants to face his peers, he might as well do it at the Masters, where he's won the green jacket 3 times, hugely popular. It's also a very select media environment. Everybody is invited into the press room in Augusta. And while he will get a hard enough time, I would think, in the press conference room, I don't think it would be as bad as if he made his return in a regular PGA Tour event. As lots of people know, the Masters is a particularly well-heeled tournament. So I think that's exactly in his mind right now, is that he'll sit out the next 5-6 weeks, perhaps, because it's going to be very awkward for him to make a return to just to the locker room, if that's the right way of putting it, and just facing up to the people who feel they've been let down by him. Because effectively he was saying that he was using all of this Super League money to leverage a better deal for what he says is a desperately badly in need of sorting out the PGA Tour. But not many of his peers feel that the PGA Tour needs as much sorting out as Mickelson feels. So he's alone in this in a lot of ways. Rory McIlroy, you know, completely outmaneuvered him without even trying to. You know, the words that McIlroy said, I don't want to kick a man when he's down, but, you know, he's naive, selfish, egotistical and ignorant. Now, gosh, if that's, you know, what McIlroy thinks without wanting to kick him when he's down, what will some other players in the locker room really feel about Mickelson? Because clearly, while Mickelson feels he's the smartest boy in the room and likes to think he is, he's not. And in many ways, he's been completely outmaneuvered by McIlroy, who is, by the way, a member of the PGA Tour's policy board, because he's chairman of the Player Advisory Council. So McIlroy is a lot more than one of the world's best players. He is the highest ranking politician, you could say, among the players. So those words coming from McIlroy were hugely, hugely damaging to Mickelson, and he is literally going to have to sit this one out for a few weeks. But I think he will come back to the Masters. I don't think there's any chance of him not playing in Augusta unless really he's in a very, very bad place.
He doesn't want to kick him out while he's down, but he's happy to land a few knockout punches anyway. But yeah, no, it is. It's going to be very interesting to see how this goes and where next for Phil Mickelson, because it's scandalous stuff. Greg, very briefly, before I do let you go, Northern Ireland's Michael Hoey has announced his retirement from professional golf to become a referee on the DP World Tour. I've just turned 43 and I see so many good young players on the Challenge Tour now. It's hard to make a living. Hoey, a 5-time winner on the European Tour and part of the victorious Walker Cup team in 2001, will begin his new role in South Africa next month as a referee. 43, I mean, Greg, that's not old.
No, and look, Michael Hoey is a player whose career is massively underrated. And I'll tell you why. Michael Hoey has won 5 times on the European Tour. And he would probably not be a name that you would associate with more European Tour victories, for example, than Paul McGinley. And one of those victories was, I think, 11 years ago. I think it was the 2011 Dunhill Lynx at St Andrews, which was star-laden. And in that tournament, he fought off a hard-charging Rory McIlroy in the final day, a hard-charging Graeme McDowell, who was playing some of the best golf of his life at that point. And Hoey literally fought them off by playing nerveless golf. I think he birdied 3 of the last 4 holes when he needed to. And when you consider the 17th hole in St Andrews, when you par that hole, it feels like a birdie. It must have felt like a 4-birdie-in-a-row finish. Michael Hoey has scaled extraordinary heights in his career. He is one of the most personable, one of the nicest guys, one of the most down-to-earth, normal conversation people you'll ever meet in sport. I'm delighted for the role that he's going to be taking on. And I think he's right. You know, if you feel your abilities are declining as a golfer, the best thing to know is when the opportunity to leave is right for you. And rather than, you know, the petering out of the years in your 40s, determining when you decide to retire with nothing at the end of it, this is an opportunity for him to stay in the game of golf and enjoy a sport he loves at an official level. And I think after a 20-year career, it's a really good idea and a great move.
Absolutely. Greg Allen, pleasure as always. Really appreciate you coming on to chat all things golf. I'm sure as this story develops, we'll have you back on once again. Soccer is up next. Stay with us.
RTE
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Football.
Hello once again. You're very welcome back to Game On. It's great to have your company. David Snaid is back in studio. We started with football, so we may as well finish with football. David, unfortunately, we don't have much time to chat about it, but it is a big night in the Premier League. Burnley, Spurs, Watford, Palace and Leeds versus Liverpool. So a lot to be decided at the bottom of the table and indeed near the top as well.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You haven't got much time because very, very simply, Liverpool need to beat Leeds to go 3 points within Man City, and the fact that they still have to play City, we actually have a Premier League title race. Burnley and Watford both need to win to have any chance of staying up. And I see the Man United team news is coming out here now as well. Ronaldo starts, Marcus Rashford starts, seems they could be in attack together. I'm trying to work this out. Like, Lindelof is playing, Maguire is playing, and so is Varane, and it looks as if there could possibly be Jadon Sancho as a right wing back, maybe even Marcus Rashford as a right wing back, and then Pogba in midfield with Fred, Bruno Fernandes is there too. So it's set up for an interesting one there, as we were talking about earlier.
Absolutely, cannot wait for that one. Also can't wait for Benfica Ajax, one for the more purists, if United Atletico Madrid doesn't tickle your fancy, and indeed the couple of Premier League matches. David, we've 30 seconds left. I asked you a question earlier about who Virgil van Dijk will equal the record of. Have you any guesses? Former Manchester United player?
Lee Sharp.
Did you Google that?
Yes, I did.
do you know what I was going to phrase actually? Because you were talking about the soaps earlier on. Yeah. I was going to say, a former Manchester United player who...
If there's one man who could be in a soap, it was Lee Sharp. He
was on Love Island, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, there you go. On that note,
Laura Lee Davis was your broadcast coordinator this evening. John Farrell was on production. I'm Shane Dawson. A big thank you to all our contributors this evening, and indeed David Snaid for joining me in studio. Tara Coomer is up next. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Slán.